Second Treatise of Government by John Locke. First published in 1689. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapters 14 through 16. Chapter 14, Prerogative. When the legislative and executive powers are in distinct hands, as they are in all moderated monarchies and well-formed governments, the good of the society requires that various things should be left to the discretion of the executive. The legislators can't foresee and make legal provision for everything that may in future be useful to the community, so the executor of the laws, having the power in his hands, has by the common law of nature a right to make use of it for the good of the society, in many cases of difficulty where the existing law doesn't deal with the difficulty, until the legislature can conveniently be assembled to make laws that do. There are many things that the law can't possibly provide for, and those must be left to the discretion of him who has the executive power in his hands. Indeed, it is appropriate that the laws themselves should, in some cases, give way to the executive power, or rather to the fundamental law of nature and government, that all the members of the society are to be preserved as far as is reasonably possible. Many events may occur in which a strict and rigid adherence to the laws may do harm. For example, a house is burning, and the fire can be stopped from spreading by pulling down the house next door, which is against the law. Again, a man may come within the punitive reach of the law, which doesn't distinguish one person from another, through an illegal action that deserves reward and pardon. So the ruler should have a power to mitigate the severity of the law and pardon some offenders. Since the purpose of government is the preservation of all as far as is reasonably possible, even the guilty should be spared when this will do no harm to the innocent. The word prerogative is the name for this power to act according to discretion for the public good, without the support of the law, and sometimes even against it. This power, while employed for the benefit of the community and in accordance with the trust and purposes of the government, is an undoubted prerogative that the executive has, and it is never called into question. The people seldom, if ever, think with careful precision about the executive's prerogative. They are far from examining it as long as it is used to some extent for, and not obviously against, the good of the people. If a question does arise between the executive power and the people about something claimed as a prerogative, the dispute is easily decided by considering whether the disputed exercise of the prerogative tends to the good or to the harm of the people. It is easy to conceive that in the early days of governments, when commonwealths were not much bigger than families, they had very few laws. Their governors were like fathers watching over them for their good, and the government was almost all prerogative. A few established laws were all that was needed, and the ruler's discretion and care supplied the rest. But when weak monarchs were led, by their own mistakes, or by the flattery of others, to use this power for their own private ends, the people had to have laws that explicitly set limits to the prerogative, with respect to matters where they found it working to their disadvantage. Thus, the people found that they had to declare limitations of prerogative, where previously they and their ancestors had given the utmost latitude to monarchs, who used the latitude only in the right way, namely for the good of their people. When the people have established positive laws setting limits to the executive's prerogative, some have said that in doing this they have encroached upon the prerogative. But those who say this have a very wrong notion of government. The people in such a case haven't taken from the monarch anything that rightly belonged to him. All they have done is to declare that the power that they had left indefinitely in his or his ancestors' hands to be exercised for the people's good wasn't something they intended him to have if he used it otherwise. Nothing is an encroachment unless it prejudices or hinders the public good. Those who say otherwise speak as if the monarch had interests other than the good of the community, and was not given the executive power for the good of the community, a view that gives rise to almost all the evils and disorders that happen in kingly governments. And, indeed, if in some commonwealth the monarch does have interests separate from those of the people, then the people under his government are not a society of rational creatures who created a community for their mutual good. They are not people who have set rulers over themselves to guard and promote that good. Rather, they are to be looked on as a herd of inferior creatures under the command of a master who uses them for his own pleasure or profit. If men were so devoid of reason as to enter into society upon such terms, then prerogative might indeed be what some men think it is, namely, an arbitrary power to do things that are harmful to the people. But a rational creature can't be supposed to subject himself voluntarily to someone else for his own harm, though someone who finds a good and wise ruler may not think it either necessary or useful to set precise bounds to the ruler's power in all things. So prerogative can be nothing but the people's permitting their rulers to choose freely to do for the public good various things on which the law is silent, or even against the direct letter of the law, and their accepting such choices when they have been made. A good monarch, one mindful of the trust put into his hands, and careful about the good of his people, can't have too much prerogative, that is, power to do good. Whereas a weak and poorly performing monarch, one who would maintain that the prerogative his predecessors exercised is his by the right of his position, a right he may exercise to promote interests other than the public's, causes the people to claim their right, and to limit the power that they had allowed while it was exercised for their good. Look into the history of England, and you will find that prerogative was always largest in the hands of our wisest and best monarchs, because the people, seeing the overall tendency of their actions to be for the public good, didn't object to what was done outside the law for that purpose. I speak of the overall tendency of the monarch's conduct, because even a good monarch may have a frailty or make a mistake, leading to small failures to achieve the public good. Monarchs are only men, made like other men. So the people, finding reason to be satisfied with such a monarch, whenever he acted outside or contrary to the letter of the law, accepted what he did, and uncomplainingly allowed him to enlarge his prerogative as he wished. In this the people rightly judged that the monarch was not doing anything that would harm their laws, because he was acting consistently with the foundation and purpose of all laws, namely, the public good. Some people argue that absolute monarchy is the best government, because it is what God himself governs the universe by, and that line of thought would give these godlike monarchs I have been discussing some right to arbitrary power on the grounds that such kings partake of God's wisdom and goodness. This is the basis for the saying, "The reigns of good monarchs have been always most dangerous to the liberties of their people." Here is why there is truth in that. Good monarchs may have successors who have different ideas about how to manage the government, and who take actions of their good predecessors as precedents and make them the standard of their own prerogative, as though what had been done purely for the good of the people, they had a right to do for the harm of the people, if they so pleased. When this has happened, it has often led to disputes, and sometimes to public disorders. The power of calling parliaments in England, settling their precise time, place, and duration, is certainly a prerogative of the king, but one that is entrusted to him to be used for the good of the nation. On the matter of prerogative, there is an old question. Who is to judge whether this power is being used rightly? I answer, there can be no judge on earth to decide between an executive power that is in existence and has such a prerogative, and a legislature that can't convene without the executives calling them together. Just as there can be none to decide between the legislature and the people in a situation where either the executive or the legislature, having got the power in their hands, plan or begin to enslave or destroy the people. In this case, as in all other cases where they have no judge on earth, the people's only other remedy is to appeal to heaven. In such cases, the rulers, exercising a power that the people never put into their hands, do what they have no right to do. And when the people as a whole, or any individual man, are deprived of their right, or are subject to an exercise of power without right, and have no appeal on earth, then they are free to appeal to heaven if they judge the issue to be important enough for that. Their right to make such a judgment is based on the law antecedent to and outranking all positive laws of men. Don't think that this lays a perpetual foundation for disorder, for the appeal to heaven comes into play only when the trouble is so great that the majority feel it, are weary of it, and see that it must be amended. But the executive power, or wise monarchs, need never come into danger of creating such a situation. And it is the thing above all others that they need to avoid, because it is dangerous above all others. Chapter 15. Paternal, Political, and Despotic Power Considered Together. I have had occasion, in earlier chapters, to speak of these separately, but it may be worthwhile to consider them together, as the great mistakes about government that have recently been made have, I think, arisen from confusing these distinct powers with one another. First, then, paternal or parental power is simply what parents have over their children to govern them for their own good, until they come to the use of reason, or to a state of knowledge that should make them capable of understanding the rules, whether the law of nature or the civic law of their country, that they are to govern themselves by. The affection and tenderness that God has planted in the hearts of parents towards their children shows that this isn't meant to be a severe, arbitrary government, but only for the help, instruction, and preservation of the children. There is no basis on which to claim that parental power should keep the adult offspring in subjection to the will of his parents. So paternal government is indeed a natural government, but its purposes don't stretch out to those of political government, nor does its scope. Secondly, political power is the power that every man has in the state of nature, and gives up into the hands of the society, and within the society to the governors the society sets over itself, on the explicitly stated or tacitly understood condition that the power in question shall be employed for their good and for the preservation of their property. So this power is to preserve his property by whatever means he thinks good, and the law of nature allows him, and to punish breaches of the law of nature by others, doing this in ways that, according to his best judgment, are most likely to favour the preservation of himself and of the rest of mankind. Thus, as possessed by each man in the state of nature, this power has as its purpose and scope the preservation of all of the man's society, that is, of all mankind. So as power in the hands of the magistrate, it can't have any purpose or scope other than that. And so it can't be an absolute arbitrary power over their lives and fortunes, which are to be preserved as much as possible. Sometimes it is, indeed, a power to deprive people of their freedom, or even of their lives, but only under strictly set conditions. It is a power to make laws, and to attach such penalties to them as may help the preservation of the whole community, by cutting off the parts so gangrenous that they threaten the sound and healthy parts. Those parts, and only those parts. No severity of punishment is lawful, unless it tends to preserve the life and health of the community. And this power stems purely from compact and agreement, from the mutual consent of those who make up the community. Thirdly, despotic power is an absolute arbitrary power that one man has over another to take away his life whenever he pleases. Nature doesn't give this power, for it doesn't distinguish one man from another, and it can't be given to someone by agreement with the other man, for no man has such an arbitrary power over his own life, and therefore can't give it to someone else. Despotic power can only come from an aggressor's giving up his right to his own life by putting himself into a state of war with someone else. The aggressor has deserted reason, which God gave us to be the rule between man and man, and the common bond whereby mankind is united into one fellowship and society. He has renounced the way of peace that reason teaches, and used the force of war to achieve his unjust purposes against someone else, and so has walked out on his own kind and joined the wild animals by adopting for his own conduct their rule of right, namely force. In this way, he has rendered himself liable to be destroyed by the injured person, or by anyone else willing to join with the victim in carrying out justice, as we would against any other wild beast or noxious brute, which mankind can't associate with or be secure from. Thus the only people who are subject to a despotic power are captives taken in a just and lawful war. Captives, that is, who were fighting on the wrong side in such a war. This power is just a continuation of the state of war. It doesn't come from any agreement, and couldn't do so, for what agreement can be made with a man who is not master of his own life? What condition can he perform? And once he is allowed to be master of his own life, the despotic and arbitrary power of his master ceases. Someone who is master of himself and of his own life also has a right to the means of preserving it, so that as soon as any agreement is made, slavery ceases, and so anyone who bargains over conditions with his captive has thereby given up his absolute power and put an end to the state of war. Nature gives paternal power to parents for the benefit of their children during their minority, to make up for the children's lack of the skills and knowledge needed to manage their property. Here and throughout I use property to refer to the property that people have in their persons as well as in their goods. Voluntary agreement gives political power to governors for the benefit of their subjects, to secure the subjects in the possession and use of their properties. And forfeiture gives despotic power to lords for their own benefit over those who have been stripped of all property. If you think about how these kinds of power differ in their origins, scopes, and purposes, you will see clearly that paternal power is less than the magistrate's power, by as much as the magistrate's is less than despotic power, and that absolute dominion, whoever has it, is so far from being one kind of civil society that it is as inconsistent with such society as slavery is with property. Paternal power occurs when the child's youth makes him unable to manage his property. Political power occurs when men have property at their own disposal, and despotic power occurs over men with no property at all. Chapter 16. Conquest. Though governments can't arise in any way except the one I have described, and political systems can't be based on anything but the consent of the people, ambition has filled the world with such disorders that this consent is not much noticed in the noise of war, which looms so large in the history of mankind. As a result, many people have mistaken the force of arms for the consent of the people, or anyway, have credited armed force with doing things that really only consent can do, and have counted conquest as one of the sources of government. But conquest is as far from setting up any government as demolishing a house is from building a new one to replace it. Conquest often makes way for a new form of a commonwealth by destroying one that already exists, but without the people's consent, it can never erect a new one. The aggressor who enters into a state of war with someone else, and unjustly invades his victim's rights, can't in this way come to have a right over whomever he has conquered. You will easily agree with this, unless you think that robbers and pirates have a right to govern people they have mastered by force, or that men are bound by promises that were extorted from them by unlawful force. If a robber breaks into my house, and with a dagger at my throat, makes me sign documents conveying my estate to him, would this give him any title to my estate? Obviously not. Well, that is just the kind of title that an unjust conqueror wins through his sword when he forces me into submission. The harm is the same, whether committed by the wearer of a crown or by some minor villain, and the crime is the same too. The offender's status and the number of his followers make no difference to the offence, except perhaps to make it worse. The only difference is this: little robbers are punished by great robbers who want to keep them obedient, whereas great robbers are rewarded with laurels and processions because they are too big to be held in the weak hands of justice in this world, and have in their own possession the power that ought to be used to punish them. What is my remedy against a robber who breaks into my house? Appeal to the law for justice. But perhaps justice is denied, or I am crippled and cannot get to the law court, or because I have been robbed, I don't have the financial means to go to law. If God has taken away all means for seeking remedy, there is nothing left but patience, being resigned to what has happened. But my son may become able to seek the relief of the law, which is denied to me. He, or his son, may renew his appeal until he recovers what he has a right to. But the conquered and their children have no court, no arbitrator on earth to appeal to. Then they may appeal to heaven and repeat their appeal until they have recovered the native right of their ancestors, namely, to have over them a legislature approved and freely accepted by the majority. Someone who troubles his neighbour without a cause is punished for it by the justice of the court he appeals to, and someone who appeals to heaven had better be sure that he has right on his side, and, indeed, a right that is worth the trouble and cost of the appeal, because he will be confronting a tribunal that can't be deceived, and will be sure to punish everyone according to what harm he has done to his fellow men. It is clear from this that someone who conquers in an unjust war can't get from his conquest any right to the subjection and obedience of the conquered. But supposing victory favours the right side, let us consider a conqueror in a lawful war, and see what power he gets and over whom. First, it is obvious that his conquest doesn't give him power over those who conquered with him. Those who fought on his side can't suffer by the conquest. They must be at least as much free men after the conquest as they were before. In most cases they serve by agreement, on condition that they will share the spoils with their leader, and get other advantages that come with the conquering sword, or at least be given a part of the conquered country. I hope that the conquering allies are not to be made slaves by the conquest, wearing their laurels only to show that they are sacrifices to their leader's triumph. Those who base absolute monarchy upon the right of the sword imply that their heroes, the founders of such monarchies, are blustering braggarts who forget that any officers or soldiers fought on their side in the battles they won, or helped them to subdue and occupy the countries they had conquered. Some say that the English monarchy is based on the Norman conquest, and that our monarchs have thereby a right to absolute rule. History doesn't support this. But if it were true, and if William the Conqueror had a right to make war on this island, his rule through conquest couldn't apply to anyone except the Saxons and Britons, who were then inhabitants of this country, and to their descendants. The Normans who came with him and helped him to conquer, and all their descendants, are free men. They are not subjects by conquest, whatever powers conquest bestows on the conqueror. And if you or I claim to be free because we are descended from them, it will be very hard to prove that we are not. Anyway, the law of this country doesn't distinguish the descendants of the Normans from the descendants of the Saxons and Britons, making it clear that the law doesn't intend that these two groups should differ in their freedom or privileges. Suppose that the conquerors and the conquered don't incorporate into one people, under the same laws and freedom. In that case, which rarely happens, what power does a lawful conqueror have over those he has subdued? The power he has, I say, is purely despotic. He has an absolute power over the lives of those who have forfeited them by waging an unjust war, but not over the lives or fortunes of those who didn't take part in the war, and not over the possessions even of those who were actually engaged in it. Secondly, I say, then, that the conqueror gets power only over those who have actually assisted, allowed, or consented to the unjust force used against him. The people never had a power to do something unjust, such as to start an unjust war, so they can't have given their governors a power to do such a thing. They ought not to be charged as guilty of the violence and injustice committed in an unjust war, except in so far as they actually abet it. The reasoning behind that also supports this. If our governors use violence or oppression against you, they weren't empowered to do so by the rest of us, and so we are not guilty of what they have done. Conquerors seldom trouble themselves to distinguish combatants from innocent civilians, and willingly allow the confusion of war to sweep them all into one heap. But this makes no difference to what is right. Thirdly, the power a conqueror gets over the defeated in a just war is completely despotic. He has an absolute power over the lives of those who have forfeited them by putting themselves into a state of war. But this doesn't give him a right and title to their possessions. I am sure of this, but at first sight it may seem a strange doctrine, as it is so flatly contrary to the practice of the world. We are all familiar with the way people, when speaking of the governing of countries, will say of some person in some country that he conquered it, as if conquest automatically conferred a right of possession. Well, it is one part of the subjection of the conquered, not to argue against the conditions cut out to them by the conquering sword. But what the strong and powerful do, however universally they do it, is seldom the rule of right. In most wars, force gets tangled up with damage, so that the aggressor harms the estates of those he makes war on. But what puts a man into the state of war is just the use of force, not the use of force to do damage. Whether the aggressor begins the injury by force, or else inflicts the injury quietly by fraud, and then refuses to make reparation and maintains it by force, either way, it is the unjust use of force that makes the war. Compare someone who breaks open my house and violently turns me out of doors with someone who enters my house peaceably and then by force keeps me out of it. These are in effect doing the same thing. I am assuming that the intruder and I have no common judge on earth to whom I can appeal and to whom we are both obliged to submit. It is the unjust use of force, then, that puts a man into a state of war with someone else, and leads to his forfeiting his right to life. The misdeeds of a father are not faults of his children, who may be rational and peaceable despite their father's brutishness and injustice. So he, by his misdeeds and violence, can only forfeit his own life, and doesn't involve his children in his guilt or his destruction. His goods still continue to belong to his children. Nature wills the preservation of all mankind as much as possible, and makes the goods belong to the children to help them to survive. Given that they haven't taken part in the war, whether through infancy, absence, or choice, they have done nothing to forfeit the goods, nor has the conqueror any right to take them away, simply on the grounds that he has subdued by force the person who attempted to destroy him. Still, he may have some right to them, to make good the damages he has sustained by the war and the defence of his own right. We shall see in due course how far this right of the conquerors reaches into the possessions of the conquered. Thus, someone who by conquest has a right over a man's person to destroy him if he pleases, doesn't thereby get a right to possess and use his estate. For the brutal force that the aggressor has used is what gives his conquering adversary a right to take away his life, but what gives the adversary title to the defeated aggressor's goods is the damage he has sustained through the aggression. Similarly, I may kill a thief who attacks me on the highway, but I may not adopt the seemingly less drastic course of taking his money and letting him go, for this would be robbery on my side. His force and the state of war he put himself into made him forfeit his life, but it didn't give me title to his goods. So, the right of conquest extends only to the lives of those who took part in the war, and not to their estates, except to make reparation for the damages received and the costs of the war. And even there, the rights of the innocent wife and children are to be respected. However much justice he has on his side, the conqueror has no right to seize more than the vanquished could forfeit. The latter's life is at the victor's mercy, as are his service and his goods, if these are needed for reparation. But the conqueror can't take the goods of the conquered person's wife and children. Take a case involving two men in the state of nature. Suppose that I have harmed another man, and have refused to make reparations, thus creating a state of war, in which my defending by force what I had unjustly acquired makes me the aggressor. In this war I am conquered. My life then is forfeit. It is at the mercy of the other man. But the lives of my wife and children are not. They didn't make the war or take part in it. I couldn't forfeit their lives, which were not mine to forfeit. My wife had a share in my estate, and I couldn't forfeit that either. And my children also, being born of me, had a right to be maintained through my labour or my goods. Thus the conqueror has a right to reparation for damages received, and the children have a right to their father's estate for their survival. As for the wife's share, it is clear that her husband can't forfeit what is hers, whether it became hers through her own work or through some agreement. What must be done if there is not enough to go around? I answer that the fundamental law of nature is that as far as possible all should be preserved, from which it follows that if there isn't enough fully to recompense the conqueror for his losses and to provide for the maintenance, he who has enough and to spare must forego some of his full reparations and give way to the greater right of those who are in danger of perishing without it. Suppose that the rights of the conqueror are so broad that the costs and damages of the war are to be reimbursed to the conqueror to the last penny, and the children of the vanquished are to be deprived of all their father's goods and left to starve and die. Still, this won't give him a title to any country that he conquers. The cost of the damages of war can hardly amount to the value of any considerable tract of land in any part of the world where all the land is possessed and none lies waste. If I haven't taken away the conqueror's land, and as the loser how could I? Hardly any damage I have done to him can amount to the value of my land, supposing it to be as much cultivated as his land is, and somewhere near the size of his land that I had overrun. Usually in a war, the most harm that is done amounts to the destruction of the crops and other output of a year or two. It seldom reaches 4 or 5. As for money and other riches and treasures that might be taken away, these are not nature's goods, and have only a notional imaginary value. Nature has put no value on them as men do. They are of no more account by nature's standard than the wampum of the American Indians is to a European monarch, or the silver money of Europe would formerly have been to an Indian. If we set aside the notional value of money, we are left with the value of land and of the products of land. Even if, as aggressor, I spoiled 5 years' worth of product of my victim's land, that doesn't add up to the value of my land held in perpetuity. The disproportion is greater than that between 5 and 500. Thus no damage that men in the state of nature suffer from one another can give a conqueror power to dispossess the descendants of the vanquished, and take from them the inheritance that ought to be theirs and their descendants through all the generations. The conqueror will indeed be apt to think himself master, and the subdued, just because they are subdued, can't stand up for their rights. But if that is the whole case for giving the land of the vanquished to the conqueror, this must rest on the entirely unacceptable principle that whoever is strongest has a right to take whatever he pleases. Thus the winner in a just war does not get, by winning, any right of dominion over those who joined in the war on his side, those in the subdued country who didn't oppose him, or the posterity even of those who did oppose him. These are all free from any subjection to him, and if their former government is dissolved, they are at liberty to start making themselves another. What usually happens, in fact, is that the conqueror compels them, with a sword at their breasts, to accept his conditions and submit to whatever government he chooses to allow them. But the question is, what right has he to do this? If it be said that in submitting, they give their consent to the government in question, this allows that their consent is necessary for the conqueror to have a right to rule over them, and leaves just one question open. Does a person consent when he makes a promise under a threat of unlawful force? And how far does such a promise bind him? I reply that it doesn't bind at all, because when someone gets something from me by force, I still have a right to it, and he is obliged to give it back to me at once. He who takes my horse from me by force ought immediately to give it back, and I have a right to take it back if I can. By the same reasoning, he who forced a promise from me ought immediately to give it back, that is, to clear me of the obligation of it. and I am entitled to take it back, that is, choose whether to do what I have promised to do. The law of nature lays obligations on me only by the rules nature prescribes, so it can't oblige me through a violation of nature's rules, such as extortion through force. It follows from all this that when the conqueror, in a just war, uses his force to impose a government on the subdued who didn't join in the war against him, they have no obligation to obey this government. But let us suppose that all the men of the community in question, all being members of the same body politic, can be taken to have joined in that unjust war in which they are subdued, so that the lives of all of them are at the mercy of the conqueror. I say that this doesn't extend to their non-adult children, for since a father doesn't himself have a power over the life or liberty of his child, no act of his can possibly forfeit the child's life or liberty. So the children, whatever may happen to the fathers, are free men. The absolute power of the conqueror reaches no further than the persons of the men who were subdued by him, and it dies when they do. And if he spares their lives and governs them as slaves, subjected to his absolute arbitrary power, he has no such right of dominion over their children. He can have no power over them except by their own consent, whatever he may force them to say or do, and he has no lawful authority when their submission comes from his force rather than from their consent. Every man is born with a double right. First, a right of freedom to his person. No one else has any power over this. It is entirely his to use as he wishes. Secondly, a right before any other man to inherit with his brethren his father's goods. By the first of these, a man is naturally free from subjection to any government, even if he was born in a place under its jurisdiction. But if he renounces obedience to the lawful government of the country he was born in, he must also give up the rights that he had through its laws, and the possessions that came down to him from his ancestors, if the government was made by their consent. By the second, the inhabitants of any country who are descended from those who were subdued and had a government forced upon them against their will, retain a right to the possessions they inherited from their ancestors. For the original conqueror never had any title to the land of that country, so the descendants and legatees of people forced to submit to the yoke of a government by constraint always have a right to shake it off, freeing themselves from the usurpation or tyranny that the sword has brought down on them, until their rulers give them a form of government that they'll willingly consent to. Who doubts that the Greek Christians, descendants of the ancient possessors of that country, are entitled to throw off the Turkish yoke under which they have groaned for so long, whenever they have an opportunity to do so? For no government can have a right to obedience from a people who haven't freely consented to it, and they can't be supposed to have done that until they are completely free to choose their government and governors, or at least have standing laws to which they have given their free consent directly or through their representatives, and also they are allowed the property to which they are entitled. That second condition means that they are the proprietors of what they have in such a way that nobody can take away any part of it without their own consent. Without that, men under any government are not free men, but slaves under the force of war. Even supposing that the conqueror in a just war does have a right to the estates of the conquered, as well as power over their persons, which he plainly doesn't, this still doesn't imply that the continuing government has any kind of absolute power. The descendants of those who were conquered will all be free men, if the conqueror doesn't grant them estates and possessions to inhabit his newly conquered country. It won't be worth anything. And if he does grant them estates and possessions, then they have property, and the nature of property is that, without a man's own consent, it can't be taken from him. Their persons are free by a natural right, and their properties, whether large or small, are their own, to be dealt with by their choice and not by the conqueror's. Otherwise, they are not properties. Suppose the conqueror gives one man 1,000 acres, for him and his heirs for ever, and to another man he lets 1,000 acres for his life, with a rental of £50 or £500. Doesn't the former man have a right to his 1,000 acres for ever? And doesn't the other have a right to his 1,000 acres for his lifetime, while paying the agreed rent? And doesn't the tenant, for life, own all that his labour and industry bring in over and above his rent, even if it is double the rent? Can any one say that the king or conqueror, after making a grant, may use his power to take away all or part of the land from the heirs of the first man, or from the second man, the tenant, during his lifetime while paying the rent? Or can the conqueror, whenever he pleases, take away from either of them the goods or money they have earned through the land in question? If he can, then all free and voluntary contracts are nullified. All it takes to dissolve them at any time is enough power, and all the grants and promises of men in power are nothing but a mockery. Can there be anything more ridiculous than to say, "I give this to you and your descendants forever," saying it in the surest and most solemn form of gift-giving that can be devised, when it's understood that I have the right to take it away from you again tomorrow if I want to? I shan't discuss now whether monarchs are exempt from the laws of their country, but I am sure of this much: they owe subjection to the laws of God and of nature. No body, no power, can exempt them from the obligations of that eternal law. Where promises are concerned, those obligations are so great and so strong that omnipotent God himself can be bound by them. Grants, promises, and oaths are bonds that hold the Almighty. Compare that fact with what some flatterers say to monarchs, namely that they are so great that they needn't keep their promises. Yet all the monarchs of the world, together with all their courtiers, are by comparison with the great God like a drop in the bucket or a speck of dust on the balance, inconsiderable, nothing. End of chapters 14 through 16.